and welcome to this special Big Boat interview. My name is Lucy Dunn and I'm the Content Director at Boat. Now, if yachts could talk. If you're a regular reader of the magazine, you'll be familiar with our feature where we delve into the archives, look back at some of history's most iconic yachts and their equally iconic owners, and retell their colourful stories. And because many of these tales are decades old, predate Google, and very often the story's protagonists are no longer with us, this can take months of detective work. It takes untold perseverance and a dedication, but when these forgotten stories are unearthed from the sands of time, they form brilliant long reads. And the writer who pens them, or should I call him the archaeologist of yachting, is Daniel Pembury, who loves nothing more than to follow a trail and see where it takes him. Daniel is a writer who once worked for Amazon in the early Jeff Bezos days and left in 2013 to write books. An avid reader of crime novels, he was living in Amsterdam at the time and realised there was a gap in the market there for these kind of books, so he decided to write his own. Along with books, Daniel writes for broadsheets and magazines, including The Times, Condé Nast Traveller and The Guardian. He also writes non-fiction books, including most recently a beautifully illustrated travel book, James Bond Destinations, published by Asselin and now in its third edition. Like characters in his books, Daniel loves using his sleuthing skills to dig out into our stories. And very often the story of how he got the story is also a story in itself, which is why we have invited him onto the podcast today to talk about two of his most recent pieces, one in this month's March issue about the fabled Christina O. Yacht, and the other about larger-than-life character media baron Malcolm Forbes and his yacht Highlander. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me aboard, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming. Daniel, you've unearthed some brilliant tales over the last couple of years. What do you love about writing these stories?
Well, I studied history at university, and I love researching and writing about huge, fascinating characters. And these feature articles combine those two things, along with yachts. So, you know, what more could a writer want?
Indeed. So the latest feature you have written for us is about the world's most famous yacht, Christina O, the iconic 99-metre ex-Canadian frigate, which was bought and converted into a luxury yacht by legendary Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis. It's a colourful tale which has often been written about, but you managed to unearth parts to the story that have never been told before, which we'll come to later. But first, can you remind listeners who Onassis was and how the yacht came about?
Sure. So Onassis became the richest person on the planet in the 1950s, following the Suez Crisis, which hiked shipping rates. And with that wealth came fame. The Greek gossip columns were always interested because in many ways he represented them on the world stage. But everyone was interested. I mean, it's not unlike Elon Musk now, though perhaps not with quite the amount of controversy, though there was some controversy for sure. Anyway, he'd acquired a Canadian frigate after World War II for around just $30,000. And deep in the Greek shipowning psyche seems to be this ethos of repurposing secondhand vessels. So he spent around $4 million converting the frigate to a yacht in the early 1950s, and that's some $50 million in today's money.
Wow. Okay. And just like her owner, Christina really captured the public's attention. Why was that?
I think, Lucy, that back then there was just nothing else like her. I mean, the superyacht lifestyle, as we now know it, pretty much evolved from the suntans and sunglasses and espadrilles and other elements seen aboard Christina. And what, you know, there had been superyachts before with big owners and glamorous social scenes, but nothing equivalent to Christina.
And Onassis, he loved to show her off to his famous friends, didn't he?
He did indeed. And in fact, one anecdote serves to showcase all that. So in 1959, which is not that long after Christina was created, Onassis invited aboard Sir Winston Churchill, John F. Kennedy as a senator, and in fact, Churchill had first met Kennedy aboard Christina, the world-renowned Greek opera singer Maria Callas, who was soon to become Onassis's mistress, and of course, Jackie Kennedy, who later became Onassis's wife. So we're talking about some of the most famous people in the world at that time, and the people that the press and the wider public crave to know more about.
Amazing. I mean, oh, to be a fly on the wall at Indeed. That time. Onassis died in 1975 and left the yacht to his daughter, Christina, and his second wife, Jackie Kennedy, with the stipulation that if neither were interested in her, they would turn her over to the Greek government as a presidential yacht. And they weren't. So what happened then?
Yeah, so neither woman wanted the yacht. In 1978, the daughter gifted it to the Greek state. And before long, the yacht was abandoned at a Greek naval base off the coast near Piraeus. You know, the costs of running and maintaining her were, of course, high. Fuel alone was an issue then as now. Actually, especially then, because oil prices had gone up sixfold during the 1970s. So there was this sort of sad inevitability about the yacht's demise. All these shiny interior features were looted. The boat was effectively abandoned for two decades. So the scavengers really went at it, picked over it. And from afar, it's a miracle the boat wasn't scrapped. Although Onassis, as mentioned, is very important to Greek people. And this was his personal yacht.
Yeah, and this is where your story starts, because in the March issue, you tell the remarkable story of Big John Papanikolaou, the uncompromising Greek businessman who rescued Christina and restored her. And he nearly broke naval architect Costa Karabelas in the process. Karabelas took on the near impossible project and suffered a heart attack weeks after completing the project.
Yeah, so Big John is one of these fascinating characters who reveal themselves over time. At first sight, he's this very big, smart, driven, dogmatic kind of guy who's been an ex-ship owner himself and a real estate player with contacts in Montenegrin casino operations, no less. And he comes across as a rough diamond and a very challenging boss.
And the yacht was literally rotting away, wasn't it? I mean, it would have been easier and probably cheaper to just buy a new yacht. So why was Big John so obsessed with buying Christina?
So here's the interesting reveal about Big John. He, in fact, came from Greek aristocracy. His parents had worked for the Greek royal family, and his father was friendly with Onassis. So as a young boy, he'd been aboard Christina.
So he knew about Christina, he knew what it was like on board.
Absolutely. He knew all about Ari's Bar and the famous bar stools made of whale scrotums. He knew all about all the visiting heads of state and the celebrities, Marilyn Monroe, John Wayne, Frank Sinatra, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and on. And he knew the boat's secrets, the views. He knew all those gleaming, almost mythic interior features. So for Big John, this restoration project was business and personal.
But Christina wasn't his first yacht, I gather. He loved yachts, especially old yachts.
He did. Though, I mean, from what I can gather, business was never far from the personal with him. So as mentioned, there's this ethos of repurposing vessels. It just seems to be ingrained in the Greek ship-owning world. And it was an ethos that Big John made good use of as a hedge against those daunting costs. So his idea was to go after famous, even infamous yachts whose renown or notoriety could take care of the marketing. So he acquired the 117-meter Galeb, previously owned by Yugoslavian President Tito, from the Montenegrin government following the breakup of Yugoslavia. Alas, the boat ended up being seized by the Croatian authorities while it was moored in the Croatian port city of Rijeka. But Big John was undeterred. Another adventure took him to Nice in France to buy Basra Breeze. You may recall that was Saddam Hussein's old boat. Big John got there, met the Greek captain. Everything seemed okay. Now, at that time, Basra Breeze was owned by the Jordanian royal family, or so he thought. Out of nowhere, two policemen and an officer of a Paris court appear, hand papers to the captain, who turns to Big John, apologizes and tells him that the boat has been seized by the Iraqi authorities. But Big John was, you know, convinced he'd get the boat, and he did.
Wow. But he sadly died in 2010. So obviously talking to him wasn't obviously not possible when you got the commission to write this piece. So what was the first thing you did in tackling the story?
Tim Morley, the broker for Christina O in Monaco, was incredibly helpful. And I explored various angles and story ideas via him. So one person who hadn't been written about was Costas Karabelis, the naval architect who took on the design and management of the rebuild.
Okay. So he hadn't given many interviews before, I gather, and you tracked him down and persuaded him to speak to you, which was a real coup. So can you describe how you did that?
Yeah, I mean, Tim Morley introduced me to Costas via video call. And Tim, I should add as an aside, is one of the very few people I've met who smiles consistently and naturally on video calls. Perhaps yourself, Lucy, is the only other person.
Ah, flattery.
So it sort of sets the exact right tone, right? So for what was one of those grand slices of luck that you hold out for when researching and writing these stories? And it's that Costas was ready to tell the story of the rebuild. After 25 years, he is now ready to pretty much tell all.
Okay, so yes. So what was it like talking to him?
Well, you have to keep in mind that Costas suffered a heart attack as a consequence of the rebuild. So the story was old ground. He probably hadn't felt like going over until now, and until the dust had well and truly settled. And with equal conviction, he described the job as a dream and a nightmare. It's this totemic Greek boat, this devilishly difficult job, and Big John, Costas's boss, accentuating the good and the bad of it all. Everything is heightened. So Costas tells me, I'm quoting him, "I don't think a person can do such a job twice in one life." And I just wonder whether we've all had an experience like this in life. So for me, it was joining Amazon in 1998 when Jeff Bezos was like some benevolent tyrant pacing the halls of what was then a pretty small office building in Seattle. And the mind is sort of making these Polaroids of these things. And so for Costas, he has these Polaroids in his head dating to 1999, 2000, and he just needs the time to share it. So I sensed there was actually perhaps a therapeutic dimension to this for him, that this is surely, you know, part of the reason why he's telling the story now. You know, I'm not saying we delve back into his early childhood or anything like that, but I did sense he needed the time to describe things in his own way. And so the calls did tend to run on some, yeah.
Oh, right. So how many hours did you chat to him?
Well, it was a fair few. But I have to add, and everyone says this about Costas, he is one of the nicest, most affable, generous guys in the business. I strongly suspect it's because of him that it worked out with the yacht and Big John.
So we've said that it was lying partially submerged in a naval base. And so, but just describe to me why the project was so ambitious.
It was a Rubik's Cube of a rebuild. So Big John's commercial vision was to scale up the accommodation from 24 to 34 guests, which doesn't sound that much, but the number of suites goes from 10 to 17, all in a time when boats rarely exceeded 5 cabins and 50 meters, and all in a narrow military hull originally built for speed. So the extra facilities, the galleys, escape routes, all these other regulatory requirements meant a lot of changes. And Big John wanted to change as little as possible about the boat, especially the external lines. But Big John's various ambitions were essentially irreconcilable.
So it sounds like there were lots of challenges, but what was the biggest one?
I mean, it's probably right at the outset. They're cleaning the hull with these high pressure hoses, and they opened up two ginormous cavities in the steel. Ultrasonic testing suggests that 65% of the hull needs replacing versus wow, 20% predicted. This meant that instead of dry docking the boat for 2 months, she spent a year there. Ultimately, 630 tons of new steel and 95 tons of aluminium were needed.
Wow. So she was almost a brand new boat by the end, I'd
indeed,
say.
Like, yeah, she was. I mean, they ended up keeping just 2 meters of the hull at the fore and the aft. And even there, there were these sunk rivets from the wartime naval frigate. They needed special protection and treatment, meaning that many times the amount of work and replacement costs were lavished just saving these fragments versus starting anew. All the pipework, cables, electrical systems, plumbing, all needed replacing. Some 56 miles of new wiring went in.
So, I mean, I can imagine Costas thinking, getting a bit stressed. I mean, that's quite a lot of work.
So Costas, back to him, he recalls being sat down by Big John, who laid out these old photos of the interiors in front of him. These photos date to the golden years of the boat. And Big John's booming, I want the interiors reinstated to be exactly the same.
And so they were just old photos. There were no GAs, nothing like that. Just working from photos was quite a tricky task, I'd say.
Very tricky task, very tricky. So Apostolos Melindris, who's the renowned Greek architect, he was appointed to do a general arrangement that could cover all the requirements. And I caught up with Apostolos, who he now runs a successful architecture practice on the Athens Riviera. It turns out Big John didn't even have that many photos. So Apostolos and his team start doing all this picture research on the Onassis years using back copies of Life and the like.
Hilarious. And there were problems with the GA. I mean, can you tell us what they were?
The dining room is a microcosm of the entire project. So a new dining room was absolutely needed, but it had to accommodate 36 guests, not 12 as the previous dining room seated.
So why was it so difficult to build a big dining room?
Its inclusion needed to avoid disturbing any of those famous spaces such as the bar. Plus, changing the layout would impact the exterior shape of the boat, but that was sacrosanct. Big John was insistent that the boat's profile could not be changed.
So how did Melindris get round this problem?
Well, helpfully, the removal of the original 1943 steam engines and boilers freed up some space. But back in went two low-speed tubeless diesel engines, and these new engines were tall. So the gap in height between the new engines and the main deck, earmarked for the new dining room, turned out to be the height of Big John, around 2 metres. Costas recalls Big John towering over him, telling him that that could not stand. So one solution was to pop the ceiling up through the main decking, but Big John flatly ruled that out.
So what did Costas do?
Yeah, well, so back in the late 90s, 3D software, design software was not widespread, and certainly Costas didn't have it. And in the end, the eureka moment came from quite an unexpected quarter. In the master stateroom, Onassis had insisted on being able to step down from a sunken marble bath. The floor, in fact, needed to be raised in order to provide the right amount of descent. Now, the bath was gone, but the idea remained. Could a similar step down work for the dining room? And the answer was yes. And the relief is plain on Costas' features a quarter of a century on.
Wow. And I also recall there were some surprises in the refit.
So this weird thing in the backstory, right? I mean, can you imagine it today? A billionaire walks into FedShip or Ocean Co. and says, I want the world's greatest super yacht, but let's start with an upcycled military vessel. So with Onassis, there was always this weird duality of grandiosity and frugality, of really shrewd financial management and out-and-out showmanship. For example, he had these El Greco paintings aboard, and they were fakes. And reportedly, he said, if people want to believe they're authentic, why spoil their pleasure? So the stateroom's gold taps, which were looted, revealed fitments that were just gold-painted metal.
Oh,
the
wow.
Glass of the counter in famous Ari's bar was so thin, according to Apostolos, that if you leaned on it too heavily, it might crack. And Apostolos had this epiphany about what a salesman Onassis had been and how central this was to the way the boat worked. So Onassis created this perception, which for his famous guests and the wider public, just became a reality. It was what people believed it to be.
Clever. So was there any of the old yacht left in the rebuild?
I mean, the pool dance floor's original mosaic tiles were retained. Also, there's a gorgeous pure copper pool surrounds. That's original as well, I believe. As is the intricate mechanism controlling the up and down movement of that floor, which is as also regarded as a work of art. Ari's bar was painstakingly reassembled, but with subtle improvements in the wood, rope, other fixtures and fittings, not to forget thickened glass for that bar top. But as I understand it, a lot of what was done was devised to retain the spirit of Anassis's yacht rather than being an exact replica. And partly this was done to upgrade to more modern requirements. But I think the approach can almost be likened to the dramatist's task, getting to the emotional truth of the past as opposed to some facsimile, which might in some ways disappoint or at least be less dramatic.
Another larger-than-life character you've written about recently is New York media baron Malcolm Forbes and his yacht Highlander. Now, Forbes was the owner of Forbes magazine and known for his high-wattage lifestyle and unashamed self-promotion. He parked his yacht up in Manhattan, filled it with art, and threw legendary parties that dominated all the gossip columns. He was the toast of New York society and a shrewd one too. Every city mover and shaker wanted to appear in his annual list of 100 most powerful, and he used his boat as a base to schmooze millionaires and billionaires and build up his media empire. And his story is such a fascinating one. So tell me a bit about Malcolm and what he was like as a man.
Here's another huge character who also reveals himself by degrees. So he's awarded a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart for service as a machine gunner in Europe during the Second World War. And this was a man who lived life to the full. You know, we're talking about hot air balloons, Harley Davidsons, helicopters, his own 727 plane, acquiring Fabergé eggs and other collectibles, not to mention homes in all corners of the globe. He takes over the family business and perfects this model of making money from the phenomenon of making money. And I'm talking now specifically about his pioneering rich list, which he started in 1981, and the advertising revenues just flowed.
And so Highlander was his fourth yacht. So can you tell me how she came about?
Sure. So she was the fourth Highlander that FedShip built, fifth Highlander in total, the very first one being a converted Canadian Corvette, hat tip to Mr. Anassis. But perhaps most significantly, she was the first one to be designed by John Bannenberg.
Okay, so what was so special about the yacht?
So I think the genius lay in Bannenberg's ability to cater to how the world's elite like to move around these spaces. Kip Forbes, Malcolm's son, said that six people aboard was comfortable, yet 60 would feel spoiled. It sounds counterintuitive, but the boat was designed for circulation. It just flowed. It had these smaller seating areas and private spaces that weren't too conspicuously private, where people could linger, never prompting that reaction, oh, look at those two over there off on their own, talking among themselves. It was about bringing together interesting people and then letting serendipity take over. People just wanted in. And Forbes used Highlander as a platform to sell advertising to visiting corporate execs. But he saw the purpose of business as being to bring pleasure and reward to as many people as possible. To him, you know, that was the point of capitalism. And indeed, that was the point of it all.
So an invite aboard Highlander was quite the invite to get in the 80s then.
Absolutely. I mean, along with the most powerful business people in America, you know, you had the toast of New York society often aboard and others beside, the future King Charles, Harrison Ford, the Reagans.
Again, I want to be a fly on the wall. In those days, they sounded amazing. So Highlander became as famous as her owner, yes?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew Winch, who was part of Bannenberg's London design team at the time of the rebuild, at the time of the build rather, explained to me how the Highlander was like a greenhouse through which you could see New York City, which certainly at that time was the meeting place of the world. And Andrew also pointed out that it had this particular night signature backdrop by those lights of Lower Manhattan, and it was enhanced by this uplit green and gold Bell Jet Ranger helicopter, Highland Fling. And by the way, one time the Highland Fling was dispatched to pick up 50 bottles of Elizabeth Taylor's Passion perfume from Bloomingdale's department store in Manhattan as gifts for a party aboard, the guest of honour being Elizabeth Taylor. So
decadent. Amazing. Love that. That's never happened to me. Forbes took her up the Amazon River, didn't he? How groundbreaking was that to do at the time? I mean, it's not sort of the Mediterranean, is it?
No, I think it certainly not. I think it really was unusual then. I mean, Forbes, who was 67 at the time, had apparently been inspired by Jacques Cousteau's trek through the Amazon 5 years before, and he went in convoy with a fellow American media billionaire, John Kluge. He's a friend of Forbes's, who owned the previous Highlander, which by 1987 was the Virginian. And it just sounded like this epic trip. I mean, the communication systems and other technologies were not what they are today, but the guests aboard included the ex-king of Bulgaria aboard the Highlander and the ex-king of Greece aboard the Virginian. Also on the Highlander was Christopher Buckley, the political satirist and speechwriter for George H.W. Bush. And he wrote a marvelous 12-day travelogue. It was the cover story for Condé Nast Traveler's inaugural edition in 1987, full of these vivid descriptions, these very odd juxtapositions, such as the Highlander. I'm just quoting him now. The Highlander steering so close to the bank, we can peer deep into the jungle, a curious and not unpleasant sensation, doing that while sitting amid a Gainsborough and a Toulouse-Lautrec, air-conditioned and sipping Bloody Marys. But best of all are these descriptions of the huge log slamming into the steel hull at night. So I found a photo in the Forbes family archives, dating to shortly after the trip, showing a typically smiling Malcolm in his signature blue blazer, posing in front of his boat, and over his right shoulder is a large scrape along the hull, just above the waterline, apparently caused by these tree trunks and root balls slamming into the boat as it's pushing its way up the Amazon.
That's amazing. I mean, it's not easy, is it, to get a super yacht up the Amazon? So we commissioned you to do this story early last year. So what was the first thing you did?
Well, I was very taken by that Amazon adventure and thought it could make a great opening spectacle. So the first thing I did was email Christopher Buckley, and thankfully he replied. So getting hold of Christopher Buckley's article, I wanted to read it and tell him what I liked about the writing, and there's plenty to like. But it turns out it's not so easy to get hold of a 1987 edition of Condé Nast Traveler. So I ended up going to the British Library shortly before it was hacked and had to close for a while. Thankfully found it there.
So when did you realise that you had the feature in the bag, so to speak?
I think when Christopher Buckley introduced me to Kip and Tim Forbes, Malcolm's sons, they were very engaged. I mean, Kip actually sent me a stack of physical photos and artifacts from his collection from his home in New Jersey. And once Kip and Tim Forbes were on board, everyone else followed. Fedship, Paul Engel, who captained the boat back in the day, everyone else came on.
It must have been amazing being able to speak to his sons, because that means that you're getting it from first hand, aren't you, the story? And you also flew to Holland to meet Henk van der Vries, Fedship CEO. I mean, how did that come about and what was that like?
So with the two Forbes sons' involvement, Fedship was keen enough to participate. But, you know, privacy is understandably such a part of their DNA. So it just felt right to do that meeting in person.
Excellent. And what was Kip's strongest memory of the boat?
Well, so at one party on the boat, Kip looked up and saw the CEOs of six different US airline companies talking to one another, which sounds rather sort of businessy and a bit dull, but it was actually unheard of in such a competitive industry. And Kip said, you know, where else would you find that? He added, quoting him, Pop remarked guests would come aboard with their own ideas of why they were there, but once on the boat, they were ours.
And Kit was the middle child out of five, and he's now 73 and continuing his father's media business. But I mean, what struck you when you met Kit? Do you think father and son had a good relationship?
I think it was, yeah, very good and warm. I mean, I do always wonder about parent-child relations in these situations. I don't think you can watch a show like Succession and not wonder. Yeah. But I tend to find that people who talk fairly openly about their parents have pretty good relations. It's the times when parents go totally unmentioned that you start to wonder.
True. And after his father's death, they kept Highland in the family for another 2 decades before they sold it. So they really must have loved the boat.
I'm sure it was a wrench to let it go. I mean, probably like selling a family home. I mean, Kip did work with Dickie Bannenberg, redecorating it in the late 1990s. But, you know, the world changes, and so too the reasons for owning such a boat.
Both Forbes and Big John are similar. They were both real uncompromising characters and absolute forces of nature. I mean, do you think this translated into the design of their boat?
I think so. I mean, I think both were very shrewd in seeing the breadth of appeal of these yachts as pleasure craft and vessels serving commercial ends. So as discussed, Forbes' boat was tied to his magazine's advertising sales. In Big John's case, he predicted at the turn of the millennium the growth of the super yacht industry and the desire for bigger and bigger boats in our century. And he actually told Costas Karabelis, you know, he said, forget about passenger, cargo or container ships, focus on yachts.
And I mean, the world is very different now. And I mean, do you think we'll ever see characters like these again?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it's hard to imagine another boat like Christina or the Highlander, because I think the world and the use of these boats has changed quite a bit. I think the world is now almost both bigger and smaller. So let me explain that. I mean, then there was a set of people, in Forbes's case, contained in Manhattan and Washington, D.C., who could assemble aboard the Highlander in pretty short order. And everyone knew everyone in that particular world. And at the same time, there were no camera phones or social media. I mean, these guests just seemed to be at ease while at play on these boats. Meanwhile, controlled coverage gave these yachts a place in the wider culture. It's quite a particular place. Whereas, you know, I guess my perception today is that the biggest yachts are understandably much more closed off and accessible only to the trusted few.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I mean, any modern iconic yachts with iconic owners you think we'll be talking about in years to come?
That's a good question. Probably Octopus, built for Paul Allen, and maybe Venus, Steve Jobs's yacht. And I guess probably also Coru, owned by Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, I mean, Octopus is so fascinating, not just because of the owner, Paul Allen, who was obviously Microsoft co-founder, but he was such a fascinating character in himself. But it was also because it was one of the world's largest yachts at the time, and it was loaned out for some big scientific expeditions. And also when it launched, it was the first yacht with dynamic positioning, which was also quite groundbreaking. And it was also a diesel electric hybrid, which was also wasn't commonplace at the time. So it was a real statement yacht.
Yeah. I mean, Paul Allen was a big sort of quite mysterious figure in Seattle when I was living there at the time Octopus was built. And you mentioned he co-founded Microsoft. He'd managed to hold on to a big chunk of the company, which is quite hard to do because people come on board and people's shares get diluted down. But he did have a big... So he was a true billionaire. And he was kind of known as this sort of polymath figure involved in all manner of things. So he owned sports teams. He was into tech ventures, history, Hollywood, music, all sorts of things. So here's this huge explorer-type boat that you've just described really well, but it's sort of shrouded in secrecy. What was sort of known about it at that time was it had a basketball court, it had this recording studio, cinema library, multiple helipads and heli hangars. And I guess the bit that was less clear that's become better known over time is it had this huge floodable dock arranged along the center line of the boat, flanked by rows of these smaller garages that had all the toys. So, you know, there's a dive center, there's a submarine, There's a separate remotely controlled submersible able to go down to the ocean floor. And my understanding is that Alan was very much using it for using the boat for discovery. So it had tremendous range. It could go to the ends of the earth. And he loved to dive wrecks. I mean, he found scores of lost warships, including some really big ones like the USS Indianapolis, the Japanese battleship Musashi, all driven by this kind of polymath curiosity. So, you know, he very much used the boats with purpose.
Mm. And then there's obviously Venus, owned by Steve Jobs. I mean, I love how it was built to look like one of his Apple products, with a passerelle made to look like a charging port of an Apple iPhone. I think it's brilliant. And obviously it had structural glass. And then
he loved his glass.
Yeah. And then on the saddest thing was that he died before it was finished. And he never had the chance to enjoy it, which, you know, was really sad.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. Very sad.
Christina, Venus, Highlander, Octopus. Do you think there's a common thread that makes a yacht iconic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I guess each of those is truly a one-off. But where I do think you'd see a similarity, it would be in the service. So I'm sure the service aboard Octopus, Venus or Coru is just as impeccable as it was aboard the Highlander or Christina. And Henk de Vries at FedShip, he said, you know, the ethos of impeccable service, when you find it aboard these boats, is, he said, the quote, the feeling of slipping into a warm bath. And I do expect that the bath feels pretty warm aboard Octopus or Coru.
Indeed. Sounds really special. Oh, thank you, Daniel. I mean, sadly, that's all we have time for today. So thank you for talking to us and coming onto the podcast. Thank you all for listening to the Big Boat interview. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to tune in every week for news and updates from the Boat Briefing podcast. This episode was mixed and produced by Adam Geist and is a production by Boat International Media. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.